You want to turn to John chapter 5. We're continuing our study through the book of John. We have dealt with two of the miraculous healings that John describes in detail. And we come to, in the first part of John chapter 5, the third. As we start in verse 1, there was a feast of the Jews. Now there had been a feast a little while back, where he had gone up to Jerusalem, and it specifically said that that was Passover. So the likelihood, it's certainly not certain because it doesn't specify which feast it was, but it's likely that this is Pentecost. Now, Pentecost was 50 days after the Passover. Penta, from our, like a pentagram, pentagon, five. So 50 days later, they had Pentecost. And it's likely that that's what this feast was. It was the one closest on the calendar to Passover coming after it. There wouldn't be another one until around the new year, which Marilyn told me about their Rosh Hashanah. I had not heard of that one before. I hadn't studied Jewish calendar a whole lot, but that's their new year. That wouldn't be coming up till much later. So if the Passover would have been in March or April, of course we know our holiday of Easter here in America is kind of tied to Passover, so we know it kind of moves around. It might be the end of April, it might be the first to the middle part of it might be the end of March or the first to the middle part of April, anywhere from about the 23rd of March to about the 22nd of April. And then 50 days later would put you into May or even into the beginning of June to get to the next holiday of Pentecost. So there likely has been a couple of months or so go by, a month and a half at least go by, since he had been in Jerusalem before, and he's back in Jerusalem again. There is a place in Jerusalem where there was a pool, and they actually, I wish I could have found pictures and brought of it. I leave Dwayne to the archaeological pictures department. But they apparently have found what they think is the remains of where this pool was that he goes to here in verse 2. In the Hebrew, it's called Bethesda. And it's got five porches. In other words, it's got five covered areas. And that'd be a very important thing, a very nice thing to have around a pool. It'd keep a little bit of the shade on some folks if they wanted to sit out of the sun and the shade. And this pool, though, was a very interesting pool. Most pools, you would think, would be used either, they would have been used either to water the animals, and this one being by the sheep gate or sheep market. The original doesn't have that word gate or market. Some will translate it gate, some will translate it market, but it just says by the sheep, which is either a marketplace where they sold and bought sheep, or else it was the gate where the sheep and cattle came in and out of the city. But it was near there, so it would have been a place where they would have been able to get water for their animals. And it also, you would think, sometimes people would use those pools to get water, to take home for various purposes. Sometimes they would use those pools even to bathe in and things of that nature, to wash up in. And so these pools that they had, a little different than we don't have. Most of the pools that we have in our country, like if you go to Washington D.C. and you see the pool there in front of the Washington Monument, they don't let you go swimming in there or anything like that. It's simply decorative. It's not there to be useful. It's just there to look pretty, a reflection pool, that kind of thing, just to have a nice bit of water there. But these pools that they had, they actually used them. They were useful to them. But oddly about this pool, something unusual. We notice in verse 3, in these five porches that it talked about just a minute ago, there were a great multitude of sick people laying there. There were blind, those that had withered arms or legs. There were those that were lame in one way or another, had some sort of handicap of some kind or another. And they were laying around under these porches in the shade. Now, possibly some of these folks were homeless folks. Some of them may have actually been living there. Imagine in our cities today, if there were homeless folks living around, like for example that pool in Washington D.C. If they were living there, they'd come and run them off. They don't want them there. That's a tourist attraction. They don't want the homeless folks or the sick and lame, the beggars, to be laying around a place like that. But here in Jerusalem, they laid around this. And it says in the end of verse 3 that they were waiting for the moving of the water. Now that's an odd phrase, waiting for the moving of the water. What does that mean? Well, verse 4 gives us an indication. Now, there's a little debate as to whether verse 4 was actually in the original or not. And I'll just say this. If it was in the original, good. I'll assume that it was. If it wasn't, somebody added this in here as a kind of a commentary to help us understand this phrase, the moving of the water. But as John included this, then it was obviously important for us to understand. He explains here in verse 4, "For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water." He stirred the water up. And what was interesting about that was whoever then was the first one to get into the water would be healed of whatever sickness they had, whatever infirmity they had. And so you can see why this would be a desirable place for people who were sick or had some injury of some kind, had some physical ailment, to be able to get into that water when it got stirred up. Now John tells this, if we assume that this is in the original, that John actually wrote this part down. John tells us this, he didn't say, well, some people believed this happened. He tells it as though this was actual fact. And it certainly would have been possible in that day and age that God used angels to do all sorts of miraculous things. And so maybe the angel did come down and stir up that water, and whoever could get in there first would be healed. But that at least, the people believed it strongly enough that they laid around. And this fellow that we're about to meet seems to confirm the fact that it actually had happened. We see in verse 5 that there was a certain man there which had had an infirmity for 38 years. So he had had for 38 years, for nearly four decades, he had been sick. He had had this problem that he has. And I want us to think about that for just a minute. So he had had plenty of experience of being around this pool, most likely. Now, I doubt that he'd been there for the whole 38 years. He probably had heard about this place. And can you imagine how far people will travel if they hear about a doctor that can cure some disease? You think about how far people will travel, how much money they'll spend to get to that place, to visit that doctor, to try to get an appointment to see that doctor that they think can heal them. Well, this man, no telling whether he lived in Jerusalem or whether he was from another place and had to travel or what, but he wanted to get to that pool, and he's now been by this pool. And we're going to see the sad state of his history there in just a moment. But before we get too far into that, I want us to talk about one thing. You know, we talk a little bit about the Greek text, and I try to, as we're talking about study, we want to study the book, we want to get to know it better. I want us to think about one thing, how much we need to appreciate those folks who studied the Greek and learned the Greek and have gone to the effort to translate it into English for us. And you know, sometimes we debate about which translation is better than this one, is better than that one, and those kind of things. And I understand that, certainly some do seem to do a better job than others. But the fact that somebody goes to that, that's a lot of work, and it's a lot of hardship for them to learn that and to try to translate that into English. And I want us to notice as we look at verse 6. In verse 6, the translation that we have in English makes this verse so clear that we can understand exactly what happens. But I want to share with you, and I'm not even going to read it in the Greek language, but I do want to share with you one of the problems that we have with translating Greek to English. And I say we, I've never translated from Greek to English. But one of the problems the scholars have translating from Greek to English is that the Greeks did not care a whole lot about what order they put the words in their sentence. And so for this one example, follow along here in your Bible in verse 6, and notice the difference in the order of the words in your English Bible compared to the words as they were in the text. Now, I'm going to actually read the English words, but in the order that they would have been in the Greek. "This one, seeing Jesus reclining, and knowing that a long already time he was held, says to him, 'Do you want sound to be?'" Now, that sounds a little confusing, doesn't it? But one of the things that the translators have to do is not only figure out what the words mean, but then put those words into an order that makes sense to us in English. And when we do that, that, for example, that could be kind of confusing. It almost sounds like at the beginning, "this one seeing Jesus reclining," we might think, oh, well, they're saying that somebody saw Jesus laying down. That's what it kind of sounds like. But that's where another factor comes into play, and that is that in the Greek, they use special word endings to let you know who's the subject and who's the object in the sentence. So, who saw whom? We do that a little bit with some things. He saw me. We wouldn't say he saw I. Then we'd be confused. Or him saw me. That'd be confusing. So we do that a little bit with words. We change the endings of them to make them fit. But that's just an idea of how the extra effort that they have to go to get these things into the right order that it makes sense to us in English. Because in English, the order of the words is very significant because a lot of our words don't change. Whether it's the object or whether it's the subject of the sentence, our word doesn't change. And that's something that's odd when if you start studying some foreign languages. Sometimes they do things out of order a little bit. I know with Spanish and French, for example, where we would say, the big brown dog, they would say the dog, big and brown. And they mix up those adjectives a little bit. But that's just something for us to think about as we look at the Bible, that these people who have translated this and put this into English for us have gone to a lot of work, and we need to appreciate that. Because if they hadn't done that, we would either have to go to the trouble to learn Greek ourselves, or we would just be completely ignorant of what the Bible had to teach us. And certainly that would not be a good option for us, not spiritually, certainly. Okay, so in the way the King James and others then kind of translate this verse and put it back into the order, then Jesus saw him lying and knew that he had been a long time sick. He said to him, "Do you want to be made whole?" And so we see the same concepts there, but grouped together and in such a way that in English we can understand what that's saying. And so we need to keep that in mind. And then this sick man, he says to Jesus, "Sir, I have no one when the water is troubled to put me into the pool. But while I am coming, another steps down before me." Now, we don't know how many times this has happened. But apparently, he has had this experience where this angel had come down and troubled the water. And he saw the water troubled and said, "Oh, I got to go get in there." But because of his disability, he couldn't get there before somebody else who maybe was either had somebody to help them or somebody else that wasn't quite in bad a condition as he is got in there before him. And so he missed his chance. Now the indication from what he says then is that this actually had worked. He had actually seen people get into that water that were sick and come out whole. Come out healed. He'd actually seen that. Now, if he had seen that, then that would indicate to us that likely it was something that really had happened. Why would he still be laying there if the first time the waters got troubled, he saw somebody get in the water and then they were still just as sick as they were before? Why would he keep hanging around? So the indication was that this was an actual miraculous thing that had been taking place here. But he explains his problem. And Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed, and walk." Now, I want us to think about something else for a minute here. We mentioned these five porches, and it said that there was a great multitude of sick people laying around in these porches. Now, I don't know how many a great multitude is. I know it's more than 5 or 10. That's a lot. There's a lot of people laying around all around the sides of this pool under these 5 porches. And one of the indications that we have of the inspiration of Scripture is that God does not answer all of our curiosity questions. He leaves us to wonder about some things. You know, human writers have a tendency and a desire to answer all the questions, to leave no stone unturned, to leave no doubt in the reader's mind. They want to try to answer everything they can. But God doesn't have any desire to try to answer every little detail that He can. He doesn't tell us exactly how many people are there. He doesn't tell us, even though He tells us how long this man has been sick, He doesn't tell us how long this man's been laying by the pool. But more importantly, and here's one of the keys, the thing that we would really wonder about, or at least I do, there's a great multitude of people here. And Jesus heals this one guy. What's the first question that comes to your mind? Because the first question that comes to my mind is, why that one? What was special about that guy that he got healed? How come he didn't heal all of them? Or if he was only going to heal one person. Now we know Jesus has the power to do. He's not limited to only be able to heal one person. He has power. So it's not a limitation of His power that kept Him from healing everybody, and He had to pick just one. But we wonder, why did He pick that guy? Did it remind Him of His dead father? Did He remind Him of old Uncle Henry? You know what? Why did He pick that guy? Was that guy sicker than everybody else? Did He look into that guy's heart and know that that guy was going to be the one that would appreciate it the most? Did He? You know, we can speculate all day long. But again, the point is, the Bible doesn't tell us why He only healed one or how He chose which one He was going to heal. And I think that's fascinating. I think that's, again, we've talked about, that's one of the things that indicates the difference in this inspired text versus just man's writing. Man would have been explaining, oh, and you know, here, this guy right here, he picked him because da, 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 he was... And that's why He healed him. That's what we see in all of our writing today, is all these details given, all these things explained. You realize we know almost nothing about this man. We know he was sick, and we know he'd been sick 38 years. We don't even know his name. Can you imagine a biography about somebody and they left out details like that? People say, what a horrible biography. Why didn't they tell us what the guy's name was that he healed? I want to know so we can look that guy up. But that wasn't God's purpose. And the purpose of this being told was not to tell everybody who the guy that got healed was. It was to point out Jesus' power. And it's an amazing thing as we look at the Scriptures to notice just how different in some ways like that they are from other writings that we may come across. All right, so Jesus healed him. Jesus said, get up, take up your bed and walk. Just like that. You see, Jesus didn't have to wait for a certain season of the year. He didn't have to say, okay, hey, I'll tell you what, I want to help you. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to leave Simeon here. I'm going to leave Simon the Zealot. He's going to stay here with you. And the next time the waters are stirred up, he's going to help you get in there before anybody else. He didn't have to say that. He just said, get up and walk. And this man did just that. Immediately the man was made whole. And we see here God's power, Jesus' power over illness and infirmity regardless of the amount of time. You know, somebody might say, doctors sometimes will say of somebody who has an injury of some kind, well, if we could have gotten to them right after it happened, we could have done something. You know, maybe somebody had a broken arm. And especially in a lot of the third world countries, you know, people have injuries of some kind and they can't get to a doctor right away. They can't just run down to the emergency room in 10 minutes like we can. Well, from here, it probably take about 15 or 20. But they can't just go down to the emergency room and have the doctor patch them up or set the bones or whatever. And so they have a lot of time. They may have a deformity in their leg or in their foot or their hand or whatever, and it may affect them. And then the doctor may say, well, you know, if I could have got to them right away, I could have set that bone and it would have healed right. But now it's healed all crooked and there's nothing we can do about it. This fellow had been this way for 38 years, and Jesus didn't say, you know, if I could have been there right when it happened, I could have done something about it. He was able to do it, even though it had been 38 years. But then here's the key. Immediately the man was made whole. Now, that's certainly a big key. We see in Jesus' healings, in his miracles, this was not just, you know, you go to the doctor and they give you medicine and you feel better in a few days. Jesus always, it was instantaneous when he did something like this. Now then, the latter part, the man did take up his bed and he walked. And then the last phrase there, the same day was the Sabbath. Now that's where it starts to become controversial. The people didn't seem to mind Jesus healing people, but they got upset about it when he did it on a day they didn't want him to do it on. And that may be very well why he healed somebody this particular day. Maybe he wanted to stir them up. The Jews see the man that's carrying his bed. He's been cured, and it's the Sabbath day, and he's carrying his bed. And they say, it's not lawful for you to carry your bed. Now, I'm not, you know, I don't know, I haven't memorized every single verse in the old law, but I haven't been able to find the passage in the law that says it's illegal for a man to carry a sleeping bag on the Sabbath day. Now, I know it says you're supposed to rest, you're not supposed to work. And I know there was that fellow got in trouble for carrying a bundle of sticks, for gathering sticks up and making a bundle of them. But I think the Pharisees have kind of added a little bit to some of God's prohibitions there. They've added some things in there and they've taken it to their own. You know, it's an amazing thing. The Pharisees actually got to the point, and this is almost unbelievable. They would argue about, you know, what was lawful to do on the Sabbath day and what wasn't. You know, it's a day of rest, we're not supposed to work. So what can we do and what can we not do? And they actually got to the point that there was one of their rabbis, one of the teachers, that actually said, on the Sabbath day, you have to lay in your bed and you can't even open your eyelids because that constitutes work. That's how far they got. But if you're laying in your bed and you open your eyes, now what's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning? Well, you open your eyes. It's kind of an instinctual thing. But he said, no, you got to wake up and realize you're awake and realize it's the Sabbath day and know not to open your eyes. And maybe that fellow should have decided that breathing on the Sabbath day was too much work. And we'll see where it goes from there with him. If he just stopped breathing on the Sabbath day, it would have made it better for everybody else. There's the problem that people have. And we talked about the things that John left out of his account here. There are many things where God did not specify, and he leaves it up to us. The problem is, there are some of us, and when I say us, I just mean people in general, religious people in particular, not necessarily us that are sitting here tonight, maybe the one that's standing here. I know I've struggled with this a lot myself. Maybe you have too. We want to fill in those empty areas. We want there to be a rule for everything. We want to always know what can I do and what can't I do. And sometimes God gives us the principle of the matter and doesn't give us the specific do this, don't do that. And we got to figure it out on our own. And we don't like that. And in some areas, he just says, hey, you know, let every man be convinced in his own mind, the New Testament says. Let every man be fully convinced in his own mind. Oh, that's a hard one for us. Because if I'm fully convinced in my mind about something, and then I see somebody else doing something different, well, what's the first thing I'm going to think? Well, they're wrong. because I'm convinced this is the right thing, and they're not doing it the way I said. They've got to be wrong. But in some of those areas, they're not. Because God didn't make a set steadfast rule on some of those things. He left it up to us to have some freedom in Christ. To have some matters that were matters of opinion, and not always, this is right, this is wrong. Some things that we can do on our own. And he leaves some of the blanks in there, just like he did in this story. But with the Sabbath day, the Jews couldn't handle that, the Pharisees particularly. So they started having to make all these rules about what you can do and what you can't do. Because all God said about it was, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, and you shall do no labor on that day. Don't work on that day. That wasn't good enough for them. They had to fill in all the blanks. Well, what is work? Now, there were some things that God did specify. You're not supposed to kindle a fire. You're not supposed to cook. You know, I bet the women were glad of that, because that gave them one day off of cooking at least, you know. One day they didn't have to cook. Now, that might mean they ate cold mutton sandwiches. I don't know. But hey, at least they didn't have to cook that day. Every week they got one day off from cooking. You know, sometimes God's laws that we see as restrictive were actually blessings in disguise to some folks. But here, we see the Jews upset that this man is carrying his bed, and they accuse him of breaking the law by doing it. And he said, well, the one that healed me, he said to me, take up your bed and walk. Well, then they want to know, well, who was that? Who told you that? Now, if you see a fellow who's been unable to walk for 40 years and he's walking, are you going to pay more attention to what he's carrying or the fact that he's walking? That's an amazing thing to think about, that they were focused on the wrong thing. They should have been amazed by Jesus' miracle, and instead they're grumbling and complaining because he's got a bedroll under his arm. He's carrying his pillow. And they're upset about him carrying his pillow. They've completely missed the point. They say, well, who told you to take up your bed and walk? Who told you that? Well, the one that had been healed, he didn't know who it was. Because Jesus had not said, hey, I'm Jesus and I'm here to heal you. He just did it. And then he disappeared. Well, afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and he said to him, you're made whole. Don't sin anymore, or something worse will come upon you. Well, what's worse than that? I don't think Jesus is threatening that some other physical ailment. He's warning him, hey, if you live a life without sin, you'll be good with God. But if you don't get away from sin, something much worse than being unable to walk and get around will happen to you. And there certainly is something much worse than that. As bad as a thing as that might be, and hard as it is to deal with, to not be able to get around like you used to or want to or whatever, that's nothing compared to an eternity separated from God because of sin. And so Jesus warns him about that. Well, then the man departed and he told the Jews that it was Jesus that had made him whole. And of course the Jews jump on that, and they begin to persecute Jesus, and they start trying to figure out a way to kill him. They want to kill him. I want you to think about that for just a minute. What terrible thing has Jesus done? He's given somebody that couldn't walk the ability to walk. Well, that is horrible. You know, everybody that ever does anything like that ought to be put to death right away, shouldn't they? What is wrong with these people? Here's somebody out there doing good, helping his fellow man. And instead of recognizing that, and more than that, he's not just, you know, it's not like he's just taking food to the homeless shelter. He's actually performing miracles. And instead of them being amazed and coming and bowing at his feet, they're going around trying to figure out how to kill him. Hard hearts. Corrupt. We talked this morning about being pure in heart. These folks are the opposite of pure in heart. wicked, evil hearts, thinking evil, bad things constantly, trying to destroy what's good. That's an amazing thing to think about. And so they apparently even came up to Jesus. And here's the way implication works. Nowhere does it say that the Pharisees or these Jews that were involved here spoke to Jesus. It just says that the Jews began to persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Now notice verse 17 though. There's an implication here that can't be escaped. But Jesus answered them. Now you can't answer somebody unless they question you about it. Unless they talk to you. Then you can answer them. Jesus answered them. They spoke to Jesus. They talked to him. It doesn't record the part where they spoke to him or what they said. Probably something very similar to what they said to him. Well, it's unlawful for you to carry. And so they started telling Jesus, well, it's not lawful for you to heal on the Sabbath day. Well, who gave you the right to tell that guy he could carry his bed? These kinds of things that we can imagine them coming up with. But Jesus answered them like this. And remember this morning we talked about Jesus saying things that were just the opposite of what society thinks. My Father works up to this time, and I work. It's bad enough that he just proclaimed, I'm going to do good works on the Sabbath day. That was bad enough. But on top of that, what has he just done? The Jews were okay with speaking of God as our Father. They were okay with that. He was the Father, you know, of the nation, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and so forth. And so we, our Father. He's our Heavenly Father. But for Jesus to say, he didn't say our Father, he said my Father. The Jews would not accept God being father to one individually like that. Collectively, they were okay with it. But they couldn't handle when Jesus said, my Father. Notice verse 18. The Jews sought the more to kill him because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Jesus' miracle ought to have been impressive enough to them to show that he had the power of God and was equal in power to God. That should have been evidence right there that he had that kind of power and the things that he had done in the past. But when he said, my Father, they just lost all ability to control themselves. And it says they tried even more to kill him after that. Now ultimately, of course, they're going to succeed in that, and it will be their ultimate failure. Their success is their failure, because they succeed in killing Jesus only to do the very thing that they shouldn't have done in killing him. And that's their ultimate failure. But we think about this. We can learn a lot of lessons about our own lives. Are we so focused on the wrong things that we miss the big things? Are we so set in our way of thinking being the only way of thinking that when something happens that we disagree with, we automatically condemn and assume that the other person is sinful and disobedient? We need to beware of some of those things. Would we ever get ourselves to the point that we'd be so upset that we'd try to kill like these Jews did? It's a sad thing to consider that they would have gotten to that point over something good that happened. Now, you know, if Jesus had been out there working, you know, he raised as a carpenter, if he'd have been out there working in the carpenter shop, you could see why they might get upset. That'd be something they might get upset about. Hey, you're not supposed to be working on the Sabbath day. Nehemiah got very upset at the people buying and selling in the marketplace and having the marketplace open on the Sabbath day. Got very upset at that when he was the governor over Jerusalem and rebuilding the walls. But that was what the law said. Don't work. If Jesus had been out there hammering around with his carpentry tools, well, then they could that he had something to complain about. But instead, what was he doing? He was healing someone. He was making someone whole again. Some of the other accounts, this is not the only person that he healed on the Sabbath day. In one of the other accounts with a woman where she had been bound by Satan for years, and they questioned him about that too. And he brought out this point. He said, you know, on the Sabbath day, don't you go down to your oxen and your sheep, and don't you let them out of their pen and take them over and let them get a drink of water on the Sabbath day? Don't you give them some of that life-sustaining liquid on the Sabbath day? Well, sure you do. And they all had to admit that they did. I don't think Jesus would have used that example if they weren't in the habit of doing that very thing. And then he asked them the question, what about this? This is a daughter of Abraham. Shouldn't she be loosed on the Sabbath day? She's been bound by him all this time. You know, Jesus did a miraculous thing here, healing someone of a physical infirmity. But the most miraculous thing that Jesus has done is something that he still does to this day. It's not healing someone who's sick in the physical sense. It's healing those who are sick in the spiritual sense. It's providing forgiveness of sin. That is miraculous. And it still goes on today. Anytime we, as Christians, commit sin and then come back to God and repent of that sin, ask Him to forgive us, He forgives that sin. Now, I know there's no big fanfare, there's no fireworks going off, it doesn't look like a miraculous thing, but the fact that that could take place, that that ever could take place, is in and of itself a miracle. Jesus' death on the cross and His resurrection that makes that possible. That was the biggest miracle of all. And if we're not Christians and we need to become Christians, He has that laid out and planned out, believing in Him, repenting of our sins, confessing Christ as the Son of God, and being buried with Him in baptism to wash those sins away. If you need to respond to His invitation tonight, maybe it's you yourself find that sin has crippled you spiritually. You need to get rid of that sin, and Jesus is the one that can do it. If you need to respond, please do so as we stand and sing.